This is Frontierland with Dr. Dean Allen.
The Sport Legends Trust was founded in 2003 by a group of South African sports enthusiasts to provide assistance and improve the quality of life of past international and provincial sportspersons and their families in times of need. I caught up with some sporting legends who were in Gqeberha recently to offer their support to this worthwhile yet little-known cause. Former cricketer and well-known commentator Trevor Quirk was in town, as was Bossy Clark, the former Western Province rugby and cricket player who is the managing trustee of the Sports Legends Trust. Rupert Spook Hanley, famous for taking a hat-trick of wickets against the mighty West Indies, was also in attendance. A talented artist, Spook has gone on to be as well-known for his paintings as his fast bowling. It was a pleasure too to share some memories with Hugh Page, the fast bowler who was the South African Cricket of the Year in 1985. Enjoy this trip down memory lane, all for a good cause. So we're here in the South Ender pub. You can hear the atmosphere in the background, which is lovely. And we've got a room full of, I could say, sporting legends. And but somebody here that you would have heard of, I've got with me now, is this legendary, if I may say so, sports broadcaster Trevor Quirk. Lovely to see you, Trevor. And how's it feel to be back in Port Elizabeth?
Oh, I always love to come to Port Elizabeth because this was almost my first area of doing cricket commentary, because the great Charles Fortune in the good old radio days, he always did the Wanderers and that area. And Kim Shippey said to me one day, I want you to go down to Port Elizabeth and do the commentary there. And the great Sid Levy used to be the sort of commentator, but he was getting on, and Kim sort of put him out to pasture. And so I used to come down and do all the commentary here. It was quite strange, actually, because I was playing Currie Cup cricket for Northern Transvaal at the same time, but we only played like every second weekend. So I would play a match, say, against Transvaal, and then I would come down here and broadcast Eastern Province, Western Province, and then 2 weeks later I would play against Western Province or Eastern Province. So it was quite funny commentating on the guys that you were actually going to play against in a Currie Cup match.
That was quite unusual, surely.
Very unusual, and I was young still then, but I loved coming to PE, and to the point of I made so many friends here, and I became almost, I think, sort of an institution at Old Grey Club. And sometimes I even used to lock up at the end of the day there. I mean, that's how we used to party in those days. And I just loved PE. And so it's always great to come back. These days, I only really come back every year to do the golf day, the Sports Legends Trust Golf Day, which is always a big success at Humid. And that's why we're back here again.
No, it's a fantastic initiative. We'll talk about how it was formed. But for me, you can just see the passion and the camaraderie in that room as the old guys start talking. Of course, a lot of them probably from those glory days, that wonderful EP Eastern Cape team of the late 80s, where you can see the memories are coming back, but they've maintained that bond, which is amazing. What can you tell us about that team?
Well, it was a very good team, obviously, you know, and it was like the Mean Machine of Transvaal in many ways, and that's why I used to love coming down here to broadcast. And, so many of the guys that you see here, you feel as though I've played against them, and I have played against some of them, but others, of course, I was just commentating on, and that was a very, very good team, and it's great to see some of the old chaps like Keith Reed and Merrick Pringle and Stryker Stradom and all those sort of guys, Clive Wilson, and, you know.
What made that team so special? Was it a team? Did you have some star individuals? But what made them stand out? Because up to that era, they were looking at the Mean Machine, those kind of players from up north.
I think that they had quite a lot of depth. So they had a decent bowling attack, and they also had good batting and people at the lower end who could actually contribute a few good runs. So they were just a nicely balanced all-round side that was scared of nobody, and they used to actually give everybody a hell of a game.
We know that Port Elizabeth, Quebec is really... If you look at your sports history, I mean, it's where cricket began, the first test match, of course, at St. George's. What makes sport special in this town? Is it always, has it got a special sporting ethos compared with some of the other, probably more established cricketing centres?
Well, I just think it's got the history, which is wonderful. And, you know, they're still at St. George's after all these years. So all those sort of things make it a very important stop in the sporting calendar. It's a bit sad that the rugby side doesn't do as well as it used to at one stage. And but there's a lot of, you know, they call it the friendly city, and that I can vouch for because I've had wonderful times here. And I mean, there's so many great sportsmen that come out of this area. And you know, I think it's sport is a great tradition in Port Elizabeth, in the Eastern Cape, and they continue to churn out top players.
So you're happy to be back here. It seems like it's almost a spiritual home for you in terms of your commentary days, your playing days, but now your golfing days. How's the golf going, by the way?
Well, my golf is very ordinary these days, shall we put it that way. But I've always loved, and you know, the lovely thing about it in the old days when I used to come down here to commentate on a Curry Cup match or whatever, or play against Eastern Province, we weren't allowed to play on a Sunday. In those days, there was no sport on a Sunday. And that was always fantastic because on the Sunday, we could then get in a game of golf. And we either played at Humewood, or we played at the Hill, or out at Wedgwood Park. And so I always looked forward to that. And that was fantastic. And I just have always loved coming here. The friendship, the camaraderie, and people are very keen on their sport.
Talking about camaraderie, I feel I've got to mention an absolute dear, great friend of yours, someone who I had the privilege to meet, the late, great Robin Jackman. A raconteur of no equal. I mean, I've been in his company. I don't think there was any subject that he didn't have a funny story that he could turn his hand to. I'd love to just share with you a story that Robin told me. We both are Englishmen that fell in love with South Africa. And once he heard my passion for this place, and perhaps the fact we challenged the authority in England on a couple of occasions. You may have heard this story. He told me once he was commentating at Lord's, the home of cricket, of course, and he had to get from the SABC studios across to, I believe, the BBC or the radio studios. For that to happen, he had to go through the members area at Lord's. So the day before, as Robin would do, he did his planning, and he saw the doorman on the members stairway there, as you probably know. We'll call him Jack for argument's sake. So he said, Jack, tomorrow I need to cut through here on my way to the other studios. Of course, Mr. Jackman, welcome home to the home of cricket, sir. You're welcome. He said, well, the day turned up when he had to make this trip across, and Robin, as you know, always had that advice. You never rush when you're going to do commentary. Better late than out of breath.
Yes.
So he gets to the doorman, and he said it was a warm day, which was unusual, of course, in London, and he said he had his England blazer and his England tie on, ready for this dash across the members' area. To which point he saw Jack at the door, and he said, good morning, and good morning, Mr. Jackman. And he said, I had my jacket over my shoulder, and I walked past him, and I walked up the stairs, to which there was a call. Mr. Jackman, sir, Mr. Jackman, your jacket, sir. He stopped. He said, I went to put it on. He said, no, please come outside and put it on and re-enter the establishment. That was something that I always remember. That is a man that played test cricket for his country, but still the decorum at Lord's demanded that. Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, the right turret of Lord's, the main pavilion, is where we were sitting broadcasting the SABC. And I handed over to the next commentator for his half hour stint, and I did the same thing. I was desperately required to go to the gents, and so I just rushed out of the commentary box, and I had to go down two flights of stairs, and as I was going down, I just heard that same call, your jacket, sir, your jacket. And I thought, if I now stop, go up the stairs again to go and get my jacket, it might all be too late. So I just ignored it, went in to the gents, and came out again, and all the way back up to my commentary box, your jacket, sir, your jacket.
You know, something I really admired about Robin, he understood what it was to be an Englishman in South Africa. I feel we were both certainly adopted South Africans, and I spent a good few lunchtimes with him. Not at the Olympic Club and not as much as the time you spent with him, but isn't that a measure of the man that whoever he was with, he made comfortable? I remember my wife, it was her first ever cricket match, she's Slovakian, and she's a sports fan, and she tried to get into the game and understood, and Robin sat there with her and explained the rules, and as the wine flowed, their laughter was just incredible. You know?
Yeah, he was a great storyteller, and in many ways I got him into commentary when he finished managing Western Province, and so I said to him, why don't you have a go at coming commentate with us? And he'd not done television at that stage. He'd done quite a bit of radio in England. And he took to it like that. I mean, he was a natural. And funny enough, my very first Currie Cup game, I played, and that's when I met Robin. He was playing for Rhodesia with Mike Proctor. They had a tremendous side that were playing in our Currie Cup in those days. And I played against Rhodesia in my first ever Currie Cup match, and Robin was playing in it. And we hit it off and became lifelong friends. And we then toured the world together, commentating to every cricket-playing nation in the world. And when he retired and I retired from broadcasting, we used to have at least two long lunches a week, and sometimes three. And then inevitably, despite the long lunch, we ended up at Olympics. It became a second home to him, and I was often there with him.
He did invite me there once or twice, but I knew I had a lot to do probably later in the week, and it would have cost me that. But wonderful memories, and a dear, dear man, and I think we were blessed, and you were certainly blessed to call him one of your closest friends.
Yeah, the Silver Fox. I miss him desperately.
No, but it's so good to have you back in Port Elizabeth, if I may call you Quirky, as most people do. And I hope you enjoy your golf tomorrow, and we'll talk more about what you're here for with the other chaps. But have a wonderful time, and welcome back to Port Elizabeth.
Thanks very much, Dean.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. So I'm here with Bossy Clark now. The party's continuing, Bossy. We're having a wonderful time, and for me, the atmosphere is fantastic. You can hear the stories, those glory days of the sport. But you're the man behind this. I mean, you're the managing trustee of this Sports Legends Trust. Before we go on to some of your sporting exploits that I want to talk about, can you just explain what the trust is about and the purpose and how it came about?
Anything that's green and like that. It really started in sort of the later part of my rugby career, where a friend of mine, I think names should be not mentioned, passed, and his family were left destitute, and that sort of sparked something in my demeanor, maybe me, who I am. Previously as well, there was Chris Berger, who today is. You've got the Chris Berger Fund, where it's only rugby, and I just thought that maybe that should be carried through rather than rugby only to all the sports. Initially it was, I must be honest with you, it was a commercial thought, a commercial way of making money in a way, because having played rugby and cricket, I thought that maybe, you know, there is a way of, but ultimately, that passed very quickly. To make money out of friends and things like that, that just didn't do me any gel at all. So, yes, and then the empathy struck me, and I thought, well, maybe the way to do this then is to do for all sports and get a team around me to actually be able to support those sports people, whether it be wives, themselves, gender, no gender, no race, whatever, and to support them in moments of stress and demise, you know. And really, at the end of the day, what I'm saying is there are a lot of sportsmen today who fall by the wayside, not through their own ways. I just unfortunately believe that, you know, a lot of sportsmen are taken up to a point where they are heralded as heroes, and it's difficult for a lot of sportsmen to accept that and to leave it. A lot of people go into business, and those people are successful. A lot of people can't go into business because they're still hanging on to that thing. So really what I'm saying is, yes, we are looking after those sports people that might fall in hard times, whether it be financial, whether it be medical, and ultimately that's what we try and do.
And you're here back in Port Elizabeth, Quebec, and this feels a special place for you. A lot of the guys in this room, we've just spoken to Trevor Quirk, were playing in that 1980 side, that successful cricket team. And isn't it wonderful to see these guys reconnect in a way like this?
Yes, you know, when we set up the trust deed, the trust deed and the trust have to be run very specifically, and it's actually very narrow-minded in its outlook, a trust. I made sure that when the trust deed was set up, we would put in a clause which is camaraderie, because at the end of the day, without camaraderie, we couldn't raise the funds that we could by just doing something without the camaraderie. So camaraderie is a very, very important aspect in our outlook, the reason for this tonight. And you'll see that a lot of people are friendly, you haven't seen each other for a long time. And I think this just generates a way of making money. And what we also do is we live on communication. One guy will leave here tomorrow and he'll go to a doctor and he'll say, geez, I went to a good place for a good reason, a meeting with a good reason, and don't you do prosthesis. And they'll say, yes, you can have the prosthesis for nothing. And this has happened too many times, or many times in our makeup, where we'd go to a doctor and they'll do it for nothing. They'll do the operation for nothing. They'll give a prosthesis for nothing. And things like that happen all the time.
Yeah. So if people offer services, I understand that you don't actually give your beneficiaries money as such. You give them what they need in terms of services, support.
Correct.
It could be legal. It could even help with their groceries. Those kind of things that you judge. Am I right in saying that the majority of your beneficiaries come from a certain era, perhaps when there wasn't the money in sport that we see today? Do you find that the case?
At the moment, very much so. In fact, yes, most of the time. I just feel that today sportsmen have paid a lot of money and they'll probably live another 10 years of their lives. And the history proves that a lot of those sportsmen don't know how to handle their money. And with due respect to a lot of them. And I just believe that sometime that's going to happen. Where a lot of, you know, past sportsmen, I don't have to mention names, where they've been heralded as heroes of the world, and suddenly they're not there anymore. And that's the empathy that we've got. We want to try and help that. We're not going to make it public to say this is what's happening, but we'd like to help that situation, which we understand is normal.
Yeah. We see that in all sports, even today at the high-level elite sport. Once an athlete has finished their career, often they're, I don't want to use the word cast aside, but they're on their own.
Expectancy.
The expectancy. We see issues in terms of, yeah, not only financial, but we see health, we see mental health in a certain extent. Because where their life has been managed, where they've had a structure, a routine, training, playing, all of a sudden that is gone.
Falls away.
Yeah. A large part of what you do is the camaraderie, is the social aspect. It's generating evenings like this where guys can get together, ladies and men who have played for provincial and the country, of course.
Correct.
Where they can come together and feel that again. Is that important?
Without the expense, at the expense of the trust. I think it's very important. It's not at the expense of the trust. It is a way of building up more communication, more contacts, to be able to get the money to be able to help and assist people financially or medical, for that matter.
Okay. Now let's turn the conversation to yourself. What I'm fascinated with, you came from an era where you played both rugby and cricket for your province, Western Province. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and more importantly, memories of playing in this town? We've got mainly an Eastern Cape audience. Have you got fond memories of playing in Port Elizabeth, or did you tend to get beaten when you came here?
No, very much so. I actually played against my cousin in the first game I played against here, and was actually a little vendetta, but it was actually quite interesting in the sense that when he was playing for a provincial side, I went up to him and he kept on inviting me to cocktail parties, and I was in the army, and I said to him, if you can do it, I will do it. And he actually took that sort of in a way that sort of saying, but hang on, who's this young upstart here? And I said to him one day, and I said, I told you I was going to do it. So yes, there's a lot of Eastern Cape feelings, yes, very much so. I went to the Western Cape, and I was very fortunate to play cricket under Eddie Barlow, and I was very fortunate to be coached by Donnie Craven. I think you can't get two better coaches in the world ever than those two, and I happen to experience both of them, and they've taught me so much in life, and I believe that that's where I am at the moment. You know, I just believe that they've taught me so much in life, and I really appreciate that.
No, fantastic names, of course, in South African sports history there. How did you balance the two? Because now children, especially aspiring athletes, are advised to choose one sport and dedicate that. How did you balance them? I mean, two very different sports, rugby and cricket. The seasons perhaps didn't overlap so much in those
days. I think it would never happen today. It could never happen today. It was quite a challenge in those days because, as I said to you, I had Eddie Boller as a cricket coach and I had Donnie Craven as a rugby coach. And eventually I had to make a decision where I started the season with respectively. And eventually I had to make that decision as to I would finish the cricket season, then I would only play rugby. So a lot of times I would get into the rugby season, I'd feel myself behind in the sense that a young upstart's coming up and then I wouldn't be playing because I've missed out on the first pressure. But that just improved my demeanor, is to say, well, you know, don't look for sympathy, you've got to do it yourself. And it happened the other way as well, the cricket side. You know. But I was very fortunate and I enjoyed it. I did two different challenges. Rugby's totally different to cricket, they're totally different friends. But I cherish the friends that I've got, and I've made a lot of friends, and I just believe I'm totally, totally privileged to have been through that situation. No, but I managed it.
you did manage it very well. You're looking very fit, that's for sure. The friendship is evident from here tonight. I just want to end by can you let people know how they could get in touch if they want to support, and perhaps even if they need some support from yourselves?
Yes, very much so. You know, it's a very sensitive situation. We don't want to splash it out. We don't want to let anyone know that we're helping anyone, unless by chance that he would like to help us do it. We obviously live off a bit of marketing because we need to know. We need to tell people how many people we've helped. I mean, to be honest with you, I think we've helped over 70 people, and people don't know that. Yes. So what we do is we rely on other people to say to tell us who needs assistance. An evening like tonight will then spark something which someone will say, but hang on, Joe Soap needs help. And then what he would do is he'd contact me, and I would ask him to fill in a form. Obviously, because there are a lot of situations where people have maybe have got a drink problem, we don't want to give cash, and then it becomes an issue. Not that issue, I'm giving drink as an example rather than the norm. That they then can come to us, and that we send them an application form, and the application form filled in by a friend of that particular beneficiary, and is sent in to us. And then we will decide how we disperse the funds to him. To give you one example, we're doing someone at the moment where we're giving him food, money for food. I mean, you know, and I think it's been well accepted. You know, and there are different ways of doing things like this. You know, it's not necessarily cash. It's not necessarily, but it's like a doctor's free admittance. Hospital free admittance, things like that. Communication.
No, it's fantastic, and I advise anybody. I mean, you've got a website, of course, and people can find you online, and I'll share those details as well. But I'd just like to end by saying, keep up the great work what you're doing. As a sportsman myself, I miss evenings like this where you get together. As I said, you can hear the glory days. I'm sure those innings get better. Those last minute tries get even more
very
magnificent,
so, yeah.
And that's all part of it. And it's about playing sport, and it's having that, it's having those memories. But it's all about supporting each other as well. So
absolutely.
Thank you for your time, and enjoy, and welcome
thanks,
back
dear.
To the Eastern Cape, and enjoy your golf tomorrow.
Hopefully we do.
Thank you.
Well, I've got the privilege here of speaking to a real Eastern Cape legend. We've got Rupert Spook Hanley. Anyone who knows their cricket would remember him steaming in. I've watched a few of the videos and probably the highlight, 1983, famous hat-trick at the Wanderers. Spook, do you remember each and every ball?
Oh, absolutely. No, it was... You always remember the good moments, and you try and forget the bad moments, you know. So,
I mean, 1983, that was a decent West Indian team, wasn't it?
Well, I think they were a better team than they are now, if you know what I mean. They had some great players there. Batters, I mean, Lawrence Roke, Alvin Kalacharan, bowler Sylvester Clark. No, they were unbelievably good side.
Incredible stuff. I mean, I just looking at the demeanour of some of those batsmen when you got them out, they weren't too pleased.
Well, I don't think any batsman's pleased when they get out.
But before we go any further, and I don't know this story, and I'm sure it's a story you've told countless times, why Spook?
Okay, now I'm actually Spook the Fifth.
The Fifth?
Yeah, and I'm Spook the Fifth. My dad, we're all St. Andrew's College boys in Grahamstown. And we had an old teacher there who was by the name of, we used to call him Drac Lucas, and he was a student teacher at the beginning of the war, and my dad obviously was the eldest, and he was nicknamed Spook. I don't know why, maybe because he was a skinny guy or whatever. He had nothing, he didn't have blonde hair, he had dark hair. And then my two uncles went there, and they were both Spooks. And then in 1963, my brother went there. And Drac Lucas was now a teacher of 80 years old. And he said to my dear brother, he used to teach maths, are you related to Tony Hanley? He said, yeah, no, he's my father. He said, well, then your name is Spook. And of course, I followed him, and I became Spook the Fifth. Yeah, so, but it stuck with me because, you know, you get a bit of a name, and it did stick with me a lot longer. But my brother still calls Spook amongst a lot of his friends.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more you can guarantee than if you've got a nickname in sport, it's going to stick.
No, it sticks. It's, you know, boarding school names always stick. It's, you know, if you were a Bowker at St. Andrews, you were a Buzz Bowker. And it didn't matter who you were Buzz Bowker. Whether you were related to the original Buzz Bowker, you were Buzz Bowker.
So tell me, if you were a St. Andrews boy, you must have had a decent cricket team going through that generation.
Oh, no, we had some fine players, yeah. Robbie Armitage was a year behind me, and he was a South African player. But then I went to Grey High School for a year.
How did that come about? That's an unusual move.
No, do you really want to know?
I do.
Okay. My dad was called in one day, and because I was quite a naughty guy at school, and they said, look here, the headmaster said, we're not expelling Rupert, but we do believe he'd be far better off at another school.
How polite is that?
So, how polite is that? You know, being St. Andrew's College, they're always polite. So I ended up at Grey High School in PE here.
So
for
what
a
I,
year.
What I don't want to surmise from that is that Gray took the outcast from St Andrews. Are we talking about
that? Yeah, no, and we had some great players. Gavin Cowley.
Amazing.
You know, Gavin was in our side. And in the rugby side, we had guys like Neil Povey, and all became Springboks and all the rest. No, no, we had a... I enjoyed my year at Grey, I must admit, yeah.
And you were close to home. Where was family at that time?
No, we were all in I lived in Mill Park, about 200 yards from the school.
Say no more. So you were close to the family, and that probably did you the world of good.
But absolutely.
Another thing that people may not know about you, but I'm sure people will know about you, is your artistry. You've turned into a well-renowned painter.
Yeah.
Where did that come about? What was the inspiration, and when did you start taking that seriously?
I always as a kid enjoyed drawing. My mom was very artistic. She used to paint quite a lot, but she used to make more dolls and all things. And I just enjoyed art. It was as simple as that.
Well, I enjoyed art, Spook, but I wasn't very good at it. When did you know that you had a talent for it?
I don't know. I ended up at art school and doing all that. I did art at Gray. I was the only guy who did art instead of maths. So it was quite a...
That was quite a thing.
Yeah, so I did art instead of maths. Then I went to the tech to do art. And then slowly just got into it. And
you've sold your paintings commercially, but what about, is it a kind of therapy? I've heard artists talk about that. Is it a way of life? You couldn't give it up?
Yeah, I was very fortunate as well. That Nelson Mandela, when he was the president, someone approached me for work. Because what happened in those days was the presidents of each country, when they visited, gave gifts. And Mandela used to hand out my paintings to all the visiting dignitaries and when he went overseas. So I ended up with paintings with Bill Clinton, Boris Yeltsin, Tony Blair, all the Queen of Denmark. So I've got a list of paintings where they all ended up going to.
Amazing, yeah. Kudos.
You know, so it was
And what did Madiba ask for a certain style of painting, or did
he just loved wildlife. He wanted to give wildlife, so that's what I painted for him.
And how long did you do that for?
Well, probably for about a year and a half, 2 years, yeah.
And then the next painter would be commissioned to do a similar thing?
He's going to Norway, or he's going to Denmark,
wow.
Queen of Denmark, and, you know. And
Did you ever have the privilege of handing over these paintings personally to anyone?
No. I used to deal with a woman called Rika, I can't even remember her surname. Wonderful old Afrikaans woman. And... she would phone me and say, we need he's going to Denmark, or he's going to England, or he's going to America. And I know that at the Clinton Foundation, his painting's in his office. Because if you go onto Rolling Stone magazine and they say, what is in Clinton's office at the thing, and it's got there a fantastic leopard painting that was handed over to him from Nelson Mandela, and that's mine.
That's incredible, and congratulations.
Yeah.
But did you know that Clinton would want a leopard painting, or was that
something that they just chose from what I've given
them.
Okay,
so you gave them a collection and they chose
correct.
That.
That's
amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Mm. Now, we're here tonight, of course, at this wonderful pub. You can hear the atmosphere in the background.
Oh, fantastic.
The innings get greater, of course. The bowling figures are getting
better. Yes,
yeah, you know what it's like.
The older we get, the better. Better we were.
Of course we were.
You know the story.
And so what do you think about this thing that we're in support of tonight, this Sporting Legends? I mean, it's a great initiative, isn't it?
I think it's unbelievable. I think anything that supports people in trouble or battling is fantastic. And I'm quite involved with it myself in Joburg and all the rest. And I think it's fantastic. Anybody who's trying to help other people is...
And it goes back to those days of camaraderie of the changing room, doesn't it? How you sort of kind of stick together.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, you help each other. That's... you team and you back each other and you, yeah, and these guys are doing a fantastic job, and I'm very pleased to finally be a part of it. I thought I was left out, you know.
No, I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure they were waiting for the right.
No, no. Well, that's what Tom and them told me. You know?
Yeah. No, I can see the warmth in which you were greeted when you arrived. That was evident.
No, but, fantastic.
No, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Right, I'm here with none other than Hugh Page. Fast bowler with the Mean Machine back in the day, of course.
Yes.
You're back in Port Elizabeth, Hugh. What's it like to be back in Eastern Cape?
Oh, it's great. You know, it's always nice to come back here because I played in the era where I believe cricket was played in the manner in which it should be. And certainly, whilst we were competitive on the field, we made a lot of great mates off the field. So, yeah, to come back all these years later and to catch up with all these guys and reminisce and tell the same stories we told 20 years ago. They're still quite humorous anyway.
But everybody seems to be getting better in their memories. That's how it is.
No, well, that's it. You know, you gather quite a few yards as you get older and you score a lot more hundreds, you know. So.
What do you think special about this organisation, these sporting legends that we're supporting here tonight?
Well, you know, when you're away from the sporting setup and you're not with all the guys that you played with, you sort of, I suppose, you forget how important a role they played in our lives and the friendships that we made and so on. And suddenly you come back into the setup and you feel like it happened, yeah, just not long ago. And you know, the friendships are still there, you know, and the understanding of one another and the respect for one another is also important, and it's always there. And it's just nice to see the guys. It's probably a little disappointing to see how some of the guys have aged, myself included. But that aside, you know, that's what sports are all about. You know, I always believed that you played it as hard as you could on the park, but you enjoyed it as much as you could off the park. And, you know, I suppose with the cricket as it was in those days, with isolation, we had to go about it in that way, in that manner. And I suppose I'm very appreciative. I'm often asked by people, am I bitter that I never played the official international cricket? And how could I ever be bitter? Envious? I'd be lying if I said I wasn't envious, but certainly, I mean, you know, it was what it was, and we had to make the most of it.
I mean, you were part of a generation of South African cricketers that, yes, arguably we can say that probably did the world stage missed out on.
Yeah,
fantastic,
I mean,
players.
Certainly, I mean, particularly from a batting point of view, we had so many great batsmen over that period. And then, you know, there were obviously some fine bowlers and fast bowlers, Stephen Jeffries, Arthur, my sort of contemporaries that were outstanding fast bowlers. And they would have been great, I suppose, spectacles for those that love cricket around the world. Yeah.
I mean, as a historian, I was obviously drawn to the Eastern Cape. I mean, this was the first ever test match played just down the road here at St. George's. What does sport and cricket in particular in this part of the world mean to you? I mean, does it have a strong heritage, a strong identity?
Well, yeah, very much so. I mean, funny enough, I finished in 95, 96, and I came down here on a number of occasions. Near Grahamstown, we played at a place called Salem, and I thought I loved cricket, but I didn't realise how much that community, the Grahamstown cricket community and so on, how much they love their cricket. And I mean, you realise that obviously this is where it all started, and you can understand why these people love the game the way they do.
It's amazing. I mean, my show's called Frontierland. We look at stories from the Eastern Cape, and you mentioned Salem.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible places where the settlers arrived, and what did they do? They built the school, they built the church, and what else did they build? That cricket pitch.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're stepping back in time, but it's. There's a pineapple tournament, of course, in that area.
Yeah.
You've got this rich heritage of cricket, not just at the top level, not just at St. George's Park, but in the communities, which we can compare, of course, when we look to the English counties and village system, the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And that's. Do you think there's a link there? Would we produce so many great cricketers?
Well,
over
very
years?
Much so. I mean, a lot of those names that are featured in South African cricket over the last 10 to 20, 30, 40 years. Of family names, and they come out of the Eastern Cape, and you know, you've not only had one or two members of the family that have played provincial cricket, but a number of families over a number of generations, which for me is the most encouraging thing.
Yeah, no, and the current setup, I mean, it's We just yeah. obviously lost to England in a test match, but can you see seeds of hope? I mean, we're still ranked very strongly.
Yes, I mean, I think our ranking is flattering, to be honest with you, Dean. But I do think, you know, we are fortunate, because I think administratively, I think the game is in a poor state. And I'm not having a cheap shot at CSA, but I think it's a fact that it's poorly run. And I said, but, you know, when you look at the schooling setup here and the schooling system, there's so many fine cricketing schools that produce cricketers year in, year out. And as I used to say to people when I was involved from a selection point of view, administratively, when I finished the game, that from a playing point of view, in that, you know, the nursery is full. It's what you do with those seedlings when they come out of school. And for me, that's been the greatest worry and greatest concern.
Yeah. And I mean, there's undoubtedly a lot of talent in this country, and that goes across all sports, of course, doesn't it?
Very much so. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm an old King Edward's boy, where, the most recent lot coming out of there were probably, I would say, Graham Smith, Adam Bucker, Neil McKenzie, and obviously Quinton de Kock. So we've had some. But yeah, I go back there and I love watching, you know, the kids play cricket at Pierce, because there's the quality of cricket is outstanding, the quality of rugby is outstanding, and it's representative, which for me is the most encouraging thing.
So just explain to the listeners what you're doing here in Pierce at the moment. We're here with the Sporting Legends.
Yeah.
It's an organisation that I wasn't aware of, if I'm too honest. But yeah. After tonight, I can see that this goes back a long way.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Bussy Clark does an amazing job with it. You know, he runs it. And, you know, there always, I suppose, will be and have been players, ex-players that have, for whatever reason, fallen on hard times, and you know, they provide help for those kind of guys, and I think that's so important. And you know you're only flattered to be a part of it. You know, the fact that I got a call to come down to PE and ask to, you know, play in the golf day and maybe be involved with their dinner tomorrow night is very flattering for me, and it's just an honour to be a part of.
No, it's fantastic, and you can see, for me, it's a privilege to stand back and watch the dynamic in that room tonight. It seems like the changing room has come alive again.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was lucky enough to play in that era where we didn't have, so we played against one another a lot, and I just love the fact that we could play competitively. And at the end of the day, you know, maybe sometimes we didn't behave as well as we should have on the park. But if we had a beer at the end of the day, or a cool drink, or whatever it may be, you had a chance to bury the hatchet. And those friendships are still as strong as ever. And I'm not here to, you know, talk about myself, but you can see the bond amongst all the guys is just incredible. And I think that's what, for me, has probably been the greatest thing about cricket, you know, the friendships I've made through the game.
And we talk about perhaps the lack of opportunity due to the politics of the country during an era. Do the old-time players, I'm sorry if I'm calling you old-time
do you
feel resentful for the kind of money that's in professional sport now?
Not at all. I think it's like anything. Yeah, things improve, standards get better. I mean, I look at some of the shots that these batsmen are playing today, some of the deliveries that the bowlers are providing, and you've got to admire it. But it's all due to, I suppose, science and technology. Guys have got everything available at their fingertips, and suddenly now you're getting amazing performances from individuals. And I'm glad that the guys are able to earn good money out of it. As I say, we missed out, but I would love to have the opportunity, all things being equal, to enjoy what the guys are doing today. Yeah.
No, it's incredible when you think about it's an ultimate privilege, isn't it, to be paid to play a sport you love? Sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, to sort of digress slightly, I mean, I'm so disappointed with this whole war that's going on in the golfing setup, you know, with LIV Golf and the PGA and the European Tour. I just think it's so sad. At the end of the day, we're all individuals, and what you may choose, I might choose differently. And as long as we respect your choice and my choice, I don't believe, to go on about things like they have is the right way to move forward. And I think in time to come, it'll all even out, and I think some of the guys who've got a lot to say might regret some of the statements they've been making about fellow competitors and fellow professionals. Yeah.
Do you think that a body such as the Sporting Legends will exist going forward in the future, or is it from a certain generation?
I think it might struggle because it takes special individuals to run it. And I think Bossy Clark, you know, he was a first-class cricketer, first-class rugby player, played for Western Province, and a very popular individual and does an amazing job. You know, I mean, I like to be a part of it, but I certainly wouldn't like to run it. And you've got to admire the job that he does and the fact that he keeps it going. And hopefully when it comes time to pass on the baton, he'll do so, yeah.
There'll be a legacy. But thanks, Hugh. Welcome back to PE. Hope you enjoy your time here.
Thank you. Absolutely brilliant.
Let's hope you have a good round tomorrow.
Thanks very much. I look forward to it.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
That was Frontierland with Dr. Dean Allen. For more podcasts, visit algoafm.co.za.